Hey, Mike.
Hello, Noah.
How you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. Hello, my name is Mike Consul. I'm a research fellow with the Roosevelt Institute, where I study financial reform, structural unemployment, and some other economic-related issues.
And my name is Noah Millman. I blog for The American Scene and for The Economist, and I am a former structured finance guy from my previous career on Wall Street.
And the last job I had before this one was a financial engineer out of the Bay Area in San Francisco. So we'll
so
be touching on.
We both fairly share our share of the blame for the end of the world, as we.
And we're both out too. We're both, I think, successfully out too. We're both in the blogging business now. And
well, you're doing more than I am to try to make up for your sins of the past, and you have fewer sins of the past. So
let's not go.
So you win.
Okay. So the first thing, speaking of sins of the past catching up on everyone, evidently there were some problems with the way mortgages were securitized during the 2000s. So
yes.
One of the big stories to break out of the past 2-3 weeks, something that was kind of percolating the blogosphere for a couple months, is the wave of foreclosure fraud and
right.
The wave of basically the foreclosure crisis in general. So I'm going to talk about that for a minute or two, kind of catch-up readers. There's been a lot of people who have been writing kind of high-level catch-up overviews because it's a very complicated topic. But one of the shortest way to approach it is that there's two problems. One is that people are being foreclosed on very quickly. And in judicial review states, so there's some states, there's 23 states, Florida is the big one here, that requires a judge to sign off on a foreclosure. And what turns out to have happened is, the people who are doing the foreclosing, the mortgage servicers, people working for the banks, and usually some of the largest banks are where this is concentrated, are foreclosing very quickly to the point where they are what's being called robo-signing documents, or more accurately, they're having people signing documents saying that these people have not paid their mortgages, but they didn't really review the documents.
Right.
And so you have people signing 10,000 of these foreclosure documents a month when you should normally spend a few hours a day, a few hours on each one,
mm-hmm.
for the typical.
Or at least an hour, right.
Exactly. There should be some burden of proof here. And this is, perjury. This is a big
right.
problem.
Right. It's not just a matter of burden of proof, right? You are testifying in court, effectively. And if you haven't actually reviewed the documents, there's a very real risk that you were lying. Yeah.
Exactly. And so that has boiled up. And one of the big issues is that you have people saying that they've reviewed something called the note, which is part of the mortgage, and it's the actual terms of your mortgage. It's the actual debt of your mortgage. There's another part of your mortgage called a lien, which basically says if you don't pay the debt, we can take your property. But they're not going and getting the notes, and they're not presenting them to a judge. And there is now other worries saying that the notes aren't actually there, that when these bonds full of mortgages, were created that the notes weren't properly transferred to where they needed to go. Many of these places that were putting them together, especially in the very front end, were like, Mike and Noah's lending on the street corner in a bad neighborhood. And, there's worry and the things that collapsed all in 2007. And there's real worry that these kind of fly-by-night operations didn't set up these bonds correctly, which would allow investors, the people who bought the bonds, to start to sue and demand money back. Because what you will notice at this point is this is from the point of view of people being foreclosed on, this is very difficult for a class action suit. Essentially, you're going to have a lot of people at the state levels. You have a lot of people with different types of claims. It's not going to be easy to organize them or get them to have some sort of legal accountability. And
right.
also there's a cultural norm, which we'll talk about whether or not we should feel sympathetic for someone who hasn't paid their mortgage in 8 months, but, wants to challenge their note, challenge the bank.
So in the background, right, we can sort of separate out sort of two different pieces of this. I think it's worth talking about both of them. One is sort of the base level justice question mm-hmm. of sort of the people who are being foreclosed on they're claiming they're being foreclosed on incorrectly or who are being foreclosed on more aggressively, even if arguably correctly, than would normally be the case. And the other side is sort of systemic issues and how does this this crisis relate. And potential responses to this crisis impact sort of the health of the financial system more generally. I think it's worth talking about both of those things to some extent separately. But in the background of all of this, right, is securitization changed the incentive structure of one side of this in the foreclosure process, right? So normally the lender, you know, right, if you live in a world before securitization, right, the originator, the lender, the servicer, these are all, you know, either the same person or closely related, and they've got a very powerful alignment of interest, right? It doesn't make sense for the lender to foreclose more aggressively than necessary, right, because they're going to be driving down the value of the property that is their security. It makes much more sense for them to negotiate with the borrower and come to a mutually workable arrangement. When that relationship is broken, right, that incentive is gone, and the servicer is now kind of hanging out on its own, able to make its own decisions. And it's not, you know, particularly if it's been securitized, it's not clear that there's anybody who is in the position of the lender, right? Any one entity who sort of has both the economic incentive to say, let's work something out that's sensible for both sides, and the ability to make that happen, right?
Right. Right. So for the audience, if we've lost the audience, we're going to continuously bring it back a level. So the best way to think of that is, what was Jimmy Stewart's bank's name in It's Wonderful Life?
It was Bailey Savings and Loans.
Bailey Savings and Loans. That's the kind of classic Jimmy Stewart bank. And up until the 1980s, or especially the late 1970s, that was very common, that you would have a bank you could go to. Building and loan. So buildings, right? Exactly. You know, the money's in the community. It's all of us and all this stuff. And there was a clear alignment. Like, Jimmy Stewart was standing there, and he negotiated your mortgage in the first place, and if you fell behind, he could renegotiate you onto a good path.
Mm-hmm.
And the new system, the securitization system, where, you know, your mortgages are sliced and diced up into tranches, and, you know, and more importantly, split on the back end. So, you know, there's a pension fund in Sweden, and then, you know, the Chinese government, and a bunch of other people all are part owner of your mortgage, because they all part own this bond of it. It's not clear if the people set up to manage the mortgage, which are different than the people who originated it, have any incentive to really make sure this happens. And there's really good arguments that they get paid more when things go bad. So there's actually incentives to not get you to a place where
you're talking about the servicers themselves.
Yeah, this is the servicers' argument. So, you know, there's the lack of accountability in the middle of this great chain here. So
right. And the servicer historically, right, had an incentive, right, to be processing things, right? The more processing they do, the more they get paid, whether that's refinancing or foreclosing or whatever. If they're not pushing any interesting paper, they don't get paid anymore. If they push interesting paper, they get paid more. But, you know, it's not just that that person is now a different person from a different entity from the entity that owns the mortgage, but that nobody owns. No single entity owns the mortgage, and it's not clear who has sort of the ability, if anyone has the ability, to take the position of the lender normally in this negotiation, as a matter of sort of their financial interests. We should say that there's a reason, or there's a public policy rationale for the securitization process existing in the first place, right, with respect to mortgages, and that is, if you are, you know, a community that's dependent on George Bailey's the Bailey Building and Loan, right, the pool of capital available for the Bailey Building and Loan is basically the savings of that community, right, and securitization made it possible to access a global pool of capital, and therefore, you know, made it much more possible to grow a community like Bedford Falls, that's what it's called, much more quickly if the economic opportunity arises. It also makes it much more, you know, easy to develop bubbles if the opportunity arises for those. But that's sort of the logic behind, like, securitizing anything, right, is that it makes it much more easy to access, to throw capital at it. You have access to a global pool of capital, and the instruments are more, or theoretically, more liquid in the aftermarket.
Right. And there's also an argument about diversification, because it's, you know, it's funny to say it out loud now, but, you know, 2003, 2005, a lot of arguments were made on the idea that we would never have a nationwide housing bubble, that we might have, you know, a housing bubble in, you know, California, but it would be offset by more stable growth in New York or whatnot. And even though in some ways this is a housing crisis of 5 to 8 states, everywhere has had a little bit of a bubble. Like, no one's really kind of leaned against it in the way that you would want something that's diversifiable to lean against. So in some ways it's tied everyone together in a much closer way. And I'm still not sure if this is a driver or not of the nationwide bubble, but when you have, exactly, when you have capital that can move to every part of the country, it also can move away from every part of the country, or also can distort every part of the country, right, in a way that we quite frankly don't have a grip on yet.
Right. But so returning to the mortgage crisis, right, mm-hmm. or the foreclosure crisis, the sort of the norms of the world of securitized finance, right, and particularly like the people who transact in the notes, you know, who create the, by notes, I mean the debt issued by these vehicles that own, you know, supposedly own piles of mortgages, right? You know, the norms of that world and the norms of the world of the, you know, Bailey Building and Loan are very, very different, and that extends to the way, you know, documentation works, right? If you are, you know, Citibank and you have transacted in a derivative on a mortgage securitization with AIG to insure the more senior portion of that securitization, you know, you're two professionals working sort of with each other, and you've got, you know, teams of lawyers on both sides, and you've also got an incentive to make the transaction work, right? And so while you want, you know, every I dotted and every T crossed, right, you're also on some level, when you're putting the transaction together, in kind of the same boat, and you have a similar incentive to, you know, to make sure that it all, you know, works out smoothly. And when it comes back to, you know, if it winds up, you know, coming into court, the court's going to look at it also as sort of two big boys in the room together. And I think, you know, if you read the Wall Street Journal editorial about the way, you know, sort of, oh, well, this is all just sort of paperwork and politics, right? What that reads very much to me like is a kind of, you know, imposition of those sorts of norms on this other world, right? You know, we all know what the transaction was supposed to be, you know, and we all, you know, agreed to the terms, and, you know, getting hung up on, you know, you know, documentation details seems like a sort of small ball, right?
Right. Like everyone knew what they were getting into, and really, why are we fighting? Like, you know, you all took a bet here, and it turned out not to work well.
Well, and that's not the way a homeowner looks at it. They didn't, you know, well, in some cases, it was the way, right? Somebody who's like buying a property in order to flip it, that probably is exactly the way they looked at it. But, you know, in general, that's not the way a homeowner looks at it, is that they just took a bet.
Right. And then there's two points there. One is, you know, to look at it from the investor and the homeowner's point of view, is that the investor is also in the same boat. But a lot of it, without getting too technical, all this stuff is from the investor's point of view, who may or may not start suing to have these mortgages bought back at par for a dollar on the dollar, even though they're only worth, you know, a quarter on the dollar, is that it's governed by New York trust law, that it's not clear that Congress can, or the federal government can quite intervene here. And the laws surrounding the creation of these things are really specific, especially when it comes to this kind of stuff. So I mean, I understand the norm stuff, but I think when push comes to shove, the language and the some states' trust law has intention, like we intended to put these notes here as very clear prerogatives, but from everything I understand, I'm not a lawyer and I have not looked at this, but I've talked to enough people at this point that says that that's not a feature of the New York trust law.
Uh-huh.
It's actually some of the strongest laws, and that's one of the reasons why, well, besides the fact that Wall Street's there, is that New York law was selected for it. But to get back to the homeowner point of view, one argument I'm trying to develop is that there's a lot of people looking at this and say, okay, to some extent, this is good and all, but this is actually really destructive because you have homeowners in homes that they don't belong in. And at the end of the day, we need to get them out quicker rather than later, that this is holding up economic activity, that we need to get as many foreclosures or as many voluntarily leaves of these homes so that people can move in, buy them, rebuild the neighborhoods, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's some things are more convincing than others. One is a kind of lucky-ducky narrative that Wall Street Journal and some other people put out that says, you know, we should be, you know, homeowners should be thanking the banks because they're getting these extra opportunities to live there when they shouldn't. And, you know, they get a nice vacation out of this, and in return all they do is just have to leave at the end. And it's actually kind of the rationale of the Florida. They set up these extra courts to handle the foreclosure processes in Florida, and the judge was basically like, you know, I don't think many of you will be able to live in your homes, but we're going to give you an extra couple months, and we'll call that a fair trade. And then there's another argument that comes out of Treasury and comes out of the Obama White House, some theory that says most of these foreclosed homes are abandoned, and they're basically an albatross on the neck of these communities. That mm-hmm. most foreclosures are in a handful of states, California, Nevada, Arizona, Florida, Michigan, a little bit Georgia. And you know, these are also places that have very high unemployment, and correlation between foreclosures and unemployment is very strong. The quicker we get these things churning back to a new normal, it is better for those communities. Mm. And what I want to argue, and give me a minute on this, is to say that this is that we're looking at this backwards. We're putting the borrower in the front seat here, when really this is a sign of a sick system. Like, this is a brand new system. It's like a car. It's like a brand new car with a kind of brand new collision system. And, you know, the airbags aren't deploying. You know, the frame is not holding up when it hit this wall. When you look at other housing bubbles, when you look at like Texas in the 80s, the mm-hmm. foreclosure rate, I was actually pulling this up, the foreclosure rate never really topped 5%.
Right.
You know, over the period, where right now we have like 12% in default. We have like a massive wave of foreclosures. And to me, that's a sign that something has gone wrong from the banking point of view, because it's all like the first rule is you never foreclose on a home from the point of view of a bank. And the second rule is you never foreclose on a home. You know, these are you always lose value in this. And there's almost always a point in between what you would take over the house for and sell it at a discount and right. what the debt is that you can renegotiate.
So I think you got to separate two things, right? You, sort of saying, well, we want to sort of foreclose a lot and very quickly in order to get us back to a new normal, right, and put a floor under the market, right, is conflating two things, right? The desire to get liquidity back into the market and enable real estate transactions to take place at prices that are realistic, and the and the notion that sort of a wave of foreclosures is the way to get there, right? And again, if you think back to sort of the, what would happen in a sort of pre-securitization world, right, what would have been the typical, approach, right, the bank wouldn't necessarily foreclose, indeed would almost certainly not, you know, jump to foreclosure, but they would not simply say, all right, we'll give you another 3 months, all right, we'll give you another 3 months, right? There'd be some kind of negotiation to change the, term of the loan or change the interest rate or change the principal or what have you, right, to turn this into something that they were more likely to get their money back on, right?
Right.
You might even have a situation where the, you know, where a borrower can be turned into a renter, right, where the you know, bank winds up owning the property but providing a lease, you know, to the current, you know, the current owner. So there are lots of ways you could theoretically get into a more liquid situation where the homeowner could theoretically sell if there's no jobs there and they need to move, right? Without having abandoned property and people on the street with their belongings. To do that though, you need to have somebody on the other side of the table, right, who has the normal interests of a lender, right? And it's not clear that there's anybody that any of the banks have that role, that they can play that role given securitization, but it's also not clear that the government can play that role, right? If the government sort of steps in and kind of imposes this, right, you've turned this from a situation where you've got a negotiation between two parties who have to a certain degree aligned interests and to a certain degree opposed interests, and they can come to a reasonable agreement, and turn it into something where you've got an outsider deciding sort of what a just outcome is in each situation. And I think that's part of what the sort of, let's call them sort of the Wall Street Journal crowd or sort of anyone who's thinking about this from the perspective of the financial industry is particularly worried about, is sort of that, well, then all bets are off on where, you know, where the game goes if that sort of a, you know, if that becomes the question.
Right. And it's important to realize that what you talk about with negotiations, the things that allow you to do good negotiations are local knowledge, expertise, time. I mean, it's a time and energy intensive thing to do. And the servicers, the people who are most in a place to do this stuff right now in the kind of new financial system we have, mm-hmm. are the servicers are by by definition, by the way they what they sell their services, is streamlined, automated, efficient, don't really exist anywhere, you know, could be moved to India, could be moved to Kentucky, wherever. You know, it's the kind of work that does not, like, independent of any type of malaligned incentives or bad legal structures, like, it's just not a good business model for doing this kind of thing. It's designed to take payments in one door and walk them to the other door. And, you know, it's also was conceived that way, in part because of tax law, in part because that's just how you would want something like this to work. So it's like a car without an airbag. And so to get
right, but I guess what I'm saying is sort of if you want, you're not going to be able to create by fiat, right, the Bailey Building and Loan, right, or the functions you want out of that, right? The government can't wave a magic wand and say we're gonna call out of the earth the people with the local knowledge and so on and so forth. The real question is what you could do to change the incentives, right? Within, you know, among the players who already exist, right? You know,
let's back up for 1 second. So, yeah. so the two big approaches that people have taken, one is to say, okay, bankruptcy judges have this local information. And in an extreme version, you could do something that we'll call mortgage bankruptcy. I think Adam Levitin and a couple other consumer law people put this forward in 07, 06 and said, you know, we don't want to encourage people to go into bankruptcy because it's going to screw up car debt and gets the auto dealers involved, which will piss them off. But basically what you want is some sort of way for a bankruptcy judge to act as the, you know, George Bailey character here and say, okay, here's what you can pay. Here's what the bank's point of view is. I'm going to rewrite the terms of your mortgage for you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, consumer takes a bad penalty because he went through bankruptcy and he has, you know, his credit's destroyed. It's public record, blah, blah, blah. You know, the bank is entitled to a certain part of the upside, and if it's not, you know, we can restructure it this way. So it kind of has a little bit of a call option in the new equity that will be built. Like, there's some sort of and say, okay, bankruptcy judges, for better or worse, are going to be the best approximation of this function. And then the second thing, and the one you're seeing momentum on, Center for American Progress is pushing this, and I think it's a good idea, is to have basically mortgage counselors at the state level.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of things that can be implemented at the state level because it avoids the Senate and because in some ways it's very much a state problem.
Mm-hmm.
It hits states with varying degrees. And so, you know, Nevada's problem is different than Nebraska's problem. And, you know, Nevada has a huge problem and you might want to take a more aggressive approach. So
right. It's
kind of setting up mortgage counselors. Now, I imagine mortgage counselors, of course, are not going to be as well as well aligned as Bank of America is. But at the end of the day, it's more an issue of finality here from the point of view of the consumer is that you have a lot of people with HAMP and with these kind of
right. Programs
that are designed to incentivize the servicer. It's not clear what's actually happening a lot of the time. You know, have people strung along for 6 months and then dropped from the program.
Right. I understand what you're saying. And I think from the perspective, if you look at it just from the perspective of sort of consumers caught in the foreclosure process, right? That, you know, clearly it's a good thing for them to have someone who's on some level an advocate, right, like a mortgage counselor, to, you know, solve their problem for them, right, and dictate terms to their lender, right? You can understand why from the perspective of sort of anyone on the other side of the desk, right, that's kind of a scary prospect.
I can't imagine why that'd be a scary prospect.
Right. So I think
yes,
what I guess I would throw on the table, and I'm not an expert at this, and I haven't studied sort of the various bits of sort of legislation that are being thrown around, right? But it seems to me what you need is something that creates a powerful financial incentive for the owners of servicers, right? Since most of the big servicers are now owned by much bigger companies, right? Something that creates a big financial incentive for them to to enter into a process like this, right? And that was sort of what they tried the first time, and it didn't work, right? I'd be curious to understand from you, like, why, you know, what was missing from the first round of this, right, where they tried to, you know, incentivize modifications.
So the theory, there's usually two theories that argue why it broke. And one is that the servicers were in the driver's seat, but as we talked about earlier, the servicers' incentives aren't clearly aligned with either investors or borrowers. They're aligned
right. With
themselves, and they're aligned with their parent company, which is important for the second reason. So there's, from their point of view, it's not hard to imagine that it's most profitable for them to string people along for 6 months and then drop them from the program. Or any of that might also be good from a PR point of view because they can release press statements saying that they're participating, yada, yada, yada. you know, so many trial modifications have been started, but it doesn't actually change the bottom line for them.
Right.
Now, on some level, that's a good story, especially if you amp up how much the servicers get paid in terms of, you know, foreclosures and distressed and non-current homes. The other part of the story that usually gets emphasized, it's one that I emphasize a little bit more than many, is the second lien problem.
And it's right.
A headache for a lot of people. But long story short is that mortgages in the U.S. are unique among debt, that you can have multiple parties take out. You can take out loans with multiple banks without telling each other. So
right.
You can get a second mortgage on your house right now, and the person who owns your first mortgage does not have to sign off on it. That doesn't exist in the corporate world for very good reasons, because, you know, it's kind of an invitation for abuse on a lot of people's part, on a lot of people's parties. And the short story is that if you wanted to write down the debt, if you wanted to write down the principal to a thing that was manageable, you would normally have to extinguish or just, you know, completely wipe out your home equity line of credit, your mortgage that's on top of your original mortgage. These second mortgages, these junior mortgages, these home equity lines of credit, there's a lot of different types, are half owned by the four or five largest banks who also own the servicers. And so the servicers, this is actually a stat I just saw recently, is that of people who are not paying their mortgage, their first mortgage, 60% of them are paying a junior lien in some form, usually a home equity line of credit.
Right, but here's what I don't understand about the argument you're making, right, is that it would seem to me that that would be a really powerful incentive not to foreclose, right? Because
right.
As long as you're making payments of some kind, or even if you're not making payments of some kind, but as long as nobody has initiated, you know, action, you're in the category of delinquent, and we can carry this second lien at some value, right? Once you go in and foreclose, right, those loans are going away, and what you're left with is the property. So it seems to me, if the problem is that servicers are too aligned with the interests of second lien holders, you would think that what you would see is, you know, basically no action on foreclosures, so that all these loans stay outstanding and can be carried at some value. And we're seeing exactly the opposite.
Well, so yeah, you're right. You're exactly right. That you're able to hold the second lien on the book at a high value, and it also acts as essentially a call option on the debt, even if it was written down, if it's still there, or call option on the equity. If you look at it, the foreclosures aren't scaling at the same pace as delinquent mortgages are. And there's this whole theory about whether or not we should talk about a crisis of strategic non-foreclosure as opposed to strategic default, about the fact that banks are holding a lot of people. Banks have a lot of people delinquent that they're not initiating foreclosing procedures on.
Right.
And, you know, they would argue that there's natural backlog in the system, that it's just it's not scalable. But I think that matches up with a second lien story. That
right, but it doesn't match up with the foreclosure crisis story, right? Like if you describe the story as, oh, you know, we've got a foreclosure crisis. Too many people are being foreclosed upon too quickly because servicers don't care, right? They don't know anything about these people. They don't care anything about these people. They also don't know anything or care anything about the lender, right? They're just trying to generate fees. You know, but on the other hand, you have another story that says, well, actually, foreclosures are happening too slowly. There's not enough foreclosures happening relative to the huge volume of delinquencies, mm-hmm. right? Those two stories, I mean, on some level, they could both be true in that the servicers could be sort of behaving badly in both directions simultaneously, but they can't both be true as sort of aggregate stories about our economic situation, right? You know, you could have simultaneously all kinds of situations of injustice where people are being foreclosed upon incorrectly or where they're acting too aggressively, and all sorts of other situations where the banks are playing games with their balance sheets, making it look like they have more performing loans than not by not foreclosing, right? But in aggregate, one or the other is predominating. So in aggregate, we either have too much foreclosure or too little.
Right. Yeah, so that does make sense. And they don't have to be entirely mutually exclusive, because the first problem is really a problem of certain firms, certain outsourced firms.
Mm-hmm.
But you could still have a problem where the process is breaking down, where it's also still not being used enough from the point of view of certain entities in the system. So that's you're right that it's a huge problem out there. So, you know, you have one out of 10 homes that are delinquent right now. So it's I think there's enough space to contain both stories, but I do agree with you that they don't point to the same obvious story.
One thing that I think is sort of interesting to think about just from a big picture perspective is when the financial crisis first sort of exploded, right, and Congress passed the TARP legislation, the original intent of the TARP legislation was to buy up these securities, right? The idea was, you know, there's some value here. Nobody's really sure exactly what it is, but we're going to stick our finger in the air and say, well, whatever the real you know, hit to these securities is, it looks worse than it really is because we also have a liquidity crisis right now. So the government will step in and buy, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of this, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of this stuff, and thereby put a floor into the market, but also clean up the balance sheets of all these entities. And that didn't happen, right? Instead, the government infused capital directly into the banks, right? And the argument was sort of a combination of, well, if you buy the securities, then you don't, you know, then basically, you know, you're taking a bet that these things are being priced right by these banks, and that's a big gift, you know, to the banks, right? And you don't have any leverage over the banks afterwards, right? If you buy into the banks, then you have some leverage. Right. The flip side of it, right, is that if a huge percentage of this market was owned by the government, right, then you would have an entity that could rip open these structures and suddenly be in the position of a lender, right?
Right. That was also, just to back up, that was also the in a sense the Geithner plan or something called PPIP, which was
right.
Going to use FDIC. This was in April
yeah.
of 2009, so well after TARP. There was a second round to try to get FDIC and Treasury to have direct ownership of all, and some hedge funds to have direct ownership. But please continue. Yeah, this was obviously very much on people's minds.
Yeah. So, you know, it all the sort of reasons why that didn't happen, why the government – I mean, on some level it did happen in that the Fed now, you know, effectively owns a whole lot of this stuff, you know, through, you know, the strategy of quantitative easing, right? They own a whole, you know, a whole bunch of stuff has been put to the Fed window that is backed ultimately by these kinds of mortgages. But, you know, the government, you know, the Treasury doesn't own, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of these securities, so they're not sitting at the table directly. All the reasons why that didn't happen, you know, and the government didn't go that route are still valid. But it is interesting to note, right, that some of what's happening now, right, is a result of the fact that those, you know, the works are still gummed up by the fact that there's no lender, right, that the lender is an amorphous cloud of institutions and individuals, and that's not ideal for cleaning up bad loans, and the government really doesn't have a good lever for inserting itself, so long as that's the case, it seems to me. I don't know.
You know what the most interesting policy for potential that someone floated? So you're right that the government could buy these mortgage-backed securities and write them down. However, by definition, it would almost certainly overpay for them. And that's a very obvious, you know, bailout for banks and, you know, and for consumers as well. One Brad Miller, a congressman from North Carolina, argued in a New Republic argument that the government has the right to use eminent domain to purchase mortgage-backed securities at par. Or, I'm sorry, not at par, at market clearing values, so for much less than they're currently being held on the books for, and then you know these things are being held.
How does that work? I don't know very much about eminent domain, but I'm surprised.
I don't know enough. It's floated is that you know the government can you know purchase things. It's in the Constitution as long as it compensates. The issue is compensation, like how much would the government pay for these? I mean, if the government's willing to pay enough, you know, every bank would sell it to them. It's arguably what's happening with the Federal Reserve. You could argue. But that the argument would be that you would – I'm going to put a link up to Brad's editorial. It was from some months ago, so I don't remember the specifics. But that the government's obligation is only to pay mark-to-market, which is what the banks aren't using as their currency. So,
well, there is no market for this stuff, right?
Right.
So mark-to-market's sort of a fiction.
Yeah.
Right.
But so is what it's being recorded at right now.
Right.
It's Yes, that's the only possible interjection on the governments, because I was a huge critic of PPIP. I thought it was the wrong way to approach it. And I think ultimately right now it put us in a bind, because we would have overpaid for something. And we would have to debate whether as a public we want to like robo-foreclose on people in order to kind of recoup our losses.
But if the argument that foreclosure is the wrong way to recover value, right, that it's actually counterproductive, right, is true, right, then you wouldn't be in that situation from a social perspective. I think, like I said, I think sort of the difficulties with pricing were there before. They're the reason it didn't happen the first time, and those problems are still there, right? But if the paramount goal is putting a floor under this whole process while doing the minimum amount of social disruption to the individual communities, right? And some of these communities already have gone away, right? But you want to minimize the degree to which you have, you know, empty buildings with, you know, crack houses and inside, or I guess now it would be crystal meth houses inside.
Because in order to segue to the next topic, many of these communities have incredibly high levels of unemployment.
Right.
And there is a big debate about what is going on with unemployment in this country. And I wrote a paper about a month ago, which I'm going to summarize very quickly for us, and says a few things. One is that for the first time, as far as anyone can tell, going back at least to the 60s, it is more likely that the unemployed are going to drop out of the labor force than find a job,
right,
which is going to have huge implications for us as we come into the recovery. Even if we assume that there's not going to be a double dip, there's a large percentage of the population that is essentially hidden from our normal unemployment records, both our records and our normal policy responses. And as there's debate about what terms to use here, I'm uncomfortable saying, you know, people's human capital stagnates as they leave looking for labor, but something's going on. They're becoming detached from the normal labor mm-hmm. mechanisms. And the other thing is that we tried to make an argument, and I think it was at least – I thought it was successful that this is not simply a supply-side problem. There is still a demand problem. We see this because for involuntary part-time labor, so people who are working part-time when they want to be working full-time, is up, and it's up – it's the highest percentage of the working population we've ever seen, and it's also up in every type of both occupation and sector. And so what that says to me is that when you have someone who's working part-time – but wants to work full-time, it means they have at least some skills. So this isn't a matter of someone, like, needs to know a little bit of math to do their job but doesn't know any. They have at least some skills, and they're also not distorted by unemployment insurance, which is a big kind of fireball in these debates, that they're, at least to the first approximation, not collecting unemployment insurance, and certainly and this is not disincentivizing them from working more hours. So I still think that there's this was a little bit more of a contentious debate a few months ago than it is now. I think the side that I'm arguing for, the Paul Krugman side, who has ultimately at least won most of this debate, says that there's still room for government response, that if we could actually get another stimulus out the door, mm-hmm. it would do good things. It wouldn't just be the government reallocating resources from point A to point B.
Right. I mean, I'm not – this is going to sound a little bit weird, but I'm not sure what the counterargument is to the claim that we have a big demand-side problem domestically, right? I mean, there's – when people talk about structural unemployment, what they mean usually by that is that you've got, you know, changes in the structure of the economy that take a certain amount of time to work through, and you've got a lot of people in certain industries, and those industries are declining, and they need to be retrained, you know, retooled for sort of, you know, for other industries. Until that happens, you know, there's going to be a certain amount of, you know, of transitional unemployment, right? And you always get more of that in recessions than otherwise, right? You know, manufacturing, employment drops more steeply, right, in recessions than it rises, you know, in recoveries, right? And that's because, you know, people, you know, firms take advantage of recessions to take actions that would be maybe more difficult to take during periods of tight labor markets, to, you know, to reorganize their businesses and you know, recessions provide, you know, in some ways an excuse for getting rid of jobs that they might have wanted to get rid of anyway. But couldn't do when business was going like gangbusters. So you always have more of that, but you know, there have been a whole bunch of analyses of the current unemployment situation that kind of – and I think Ben Bernanke himself said in his most recent speech that, you know, there's no good way to make that kind of transitional unemployment explain any more than a fraction of the unemployment that we see. That still leaves open the question of kind of what exactly the levers are that the government has, right, to directly alleviate the problem of unemployment, right?
Before we continue on, I just want to throw out the arguments that I've seen that are most convincing are twofold. One is, obviously that there's a growing education premium and that our workforce is not as educated as the demand requires. And the IMF put that at 0.5%. I don't know if that's correct or not, but let's just ballpark it at 0.5%. And they gave another
0.5% of unemployment is due to that?
Yeah, 0.5% of the rise. So if you think that the natural rate of unemployment was 5%, it's now 6.5%. This is kind of the strongest version I've heard. The other 1% is basically mortgage debt hangover, and that they correlate the other part with foreclosures, which mm-hmm. also correlates with communities that are just very much underwater that had the biggest housing bubble. And there's not a great causation story there because wherever you see, obviously these places that had a huge housing bubble overinvested in construction, certain types of labor that are
right.
But they also had the biggest retrenchment of state budgets. So, you have teachers being laid off, which causes kind of cascading effects. And so I do think that there's a story there, and it's why you would see. And I think it's very convincing locally. Like, it explains why Nevada is, like, a complete mess. It has, like, 14% unemployment or something.
Right, although what you'd expect to see, right, if you had really bad regional situations in, let's say, Las Vegas area and Phoenix area and so forth, right, what you'd expect to see is an acute municipal crisis, right, as you have a huge amount of out-migration, right, from those areas, and suddenly your tax base has shrunk and you've got this, you have a Detroit-type situation. We have a city built for 2 million people and we only have 900,000 people in it, but you don't have a nationwide unemployment crisis because of that unless you have, a nationwide, classic recession, right? Which we do. I don't buy into the story that sort of this is the other thing to say about construction, right? Is that there was a very large percentage. It's obviously not a majority, but a large percentage of immigrant labor in the construction industry specifically, and you've seen a big shift in migratory patterns, at least in the first couple of years. After the financial crisis, right, as a result of that. So you had people going home, to Mexico or El Salvador or, what have you, or not coming in the same numbers in that period. So you would think that that would also, to some extent, alleviate the degree to which, right, the unemployment crisis is sort of structurally related to the construction industry specifically.
It's actually ironic that there's good arguments that if we had built a wall in Mexico or increased border security, it makes it harder for people to migrate back home as opposed to like come this way. And if it had been built in 2006, it essentially would have kept a lot of people here that naturally would have wanted to go home as part of the recession. Yeah. So it would have done the exact opposite of what the nativists really wanted, which I always thought was amusing. But anyway. What can be done about this is very discouraging. I'd like you to talk about it for a little bit.
Well, I mean, I think sort of the unspoken, if you read sort of Bernanke's, academic work, right? He was a big, his argument always was, that the Fed always can do more, right? If the goal is to generate demand, the Fed can always do it, right? It has the tools at its disposal to, in the analogy that gave him his nickname, right? And the Fed could always just fly over people with a helicopter and drop money on them, right? And you will definitely reduce the value of money then, which will cause people to spend in exchange for goods and services instead of hoarding cash, right? So that's theoretically what he believes. Right, and if you take that at face value, then he believes he can solve the unemployment crisis, tomorrow. What he said in his speech, and which I think he really believes, is that the Fed's credibility would be devastated if they made if they did something literally like that, if they literally flew around with helicopters dropping money on people, right, people would lose confidence in the value of the dollar, and you know, any, and that would swamp any effort to increase demand, right? You'd have a whole new level of crisis, you know, because people wouldn't believe in the value of money at all. It wouldn't simply, they wouldn't simply believe, oh, the Fed's only trying to get inflation up to 3% or 4% or whatever for a short time being. They would believe, oh, the Fed's going nuts. And more to the point, when you say sort of people, right, we're to some extent talking about, you know, ordinary savers in the United States, but to some extent we're talking about the central banks of China and Japan, right? And I think sort of that international dimension kind of can't be ignored. There's an alignment of interest between there is obviously a not perfect alignment of interest between debtors and lenders, you know, in any situation, right? And the government can lean more in one direction or more in the other direction, put their thumb on the scale more towards debtors, put the thumb on the scale more towards lenders, and there are all sorts of different pressure points within our system that that work that way and always have. When you a substantial fraction of your debt is held, you know, internationally, this is no longer a domestic political debate, right? It's no longer we've got, you know, the you know, populists or progressives against, you know, conservatives or, you know, the banks and trusts or whatever, what have you, you know, arguing over who, you know, is more important to the future of the nation and who deserves a break today. But you've got the concern about how who is going to finance, you know, who oversees the pool of savings overseas is going to finance the substantial fiscal deficits in the United States faces. So I think that when Bernanke talks about the Fed's credibility, that's what's in the background, is the sense that, you know, this is, you know, the U.S. doesn't have full freedom of action at this point to manipulate its economy the way it might ideally want to in some hypothetical world.
What's your take on the China peg battle?
You know, I've always taken a different perspective, I think, than a lot of people, and certainly than Paul Krugman, right? Krugman seems, periodically he gets on a real sort of, you know, tear about the China peg, right? And it's always seemed to me that the real risk to the United States is not, you know, that China, you know, continues to keep its currency, you know, reasonably stable versus the dollar, but that you have a crisis where the Chinese currency rapidly revalues upward versus the dollar, right? That would have a devastating effect on America. I mean, it would be caused by a loss of confidence internationally in the United States, right? And would mean a dramatic inability by the United States, you know, to borrow at anything resembling the rates that we borrow today. And so it seems to me, you know, China's development path has been very, very different from Japan and South Korea's, right? If you look at the companies that are doing most of the exporting, you know, and that are part of the sort of Ricardian integration across the Pacific, right, whereby, you know, certain parts of the value chain have all migrated, you know, to China, and you have, you know, things designed in the United States and then, you know, manufactured in China and then, you know, marketed in the United States. You know, it's not, you know, in Japan's case, it was these huge industrial firms, right, that were intimately connected with banks and so on and so forth. In China, and the same thing happened in South Korea. In China's case, it's mostly really, you know, small and mid-sized firms, zillions of little firms in southern China that are the core of their export engine, right? And the big industrial sort of conglomerates, which China does have and which frequently have sort of a state, you know, component to their ownership and a close connection with state banks, right, aren't the big drivers of export growth. I think the China peg story and what that has to do with China's own development is very different from the way it's frequently described. And I think the Chinese would say, if you ask them, that you know, in many ways we're more at risk than they are from that unraveling badly.
Right, right. And what I always look at, or what I also look at, is it's not clear to me if it's worth fighting out the currency policy based on the estimates of what we'll gain from it. So if you think of it as, you know, pros and cons, you know, obviously
right.
the international stability is a major con, and it has that kind of tail risk that always worries me, where, you know, this could actually cause an escalation and cause other kind of political economy problems. But on the plus side, even if it's executed very well, J.W. Mason at New Deal 2.0, we'll try to put a link up to this, you know, he went through where the current research is and says, you know, maybe this will boost GDP 0.5% over a couple of years.
Right.
Maybe. Like, and, you know, Frost, but what's his first name, at American Scene has been writing about this as well.
Walker Frost, yeah.
Walker Frost has been writing about this as well. Says, you know, the upside is not really that strong. I mean, there is an upside, right? There is a maladjustment, if you will. If you don't want to go into currency war language, there's obviously a maladjustment or misadjustment of currency regimes. But if you look at how much ground you'll gain from fighting this war, is it, you know, is it enough to bury the bodies that you'll get out of it? And it's not clear to me that it is. And so given, and when you look at Keynes, you look, the argument for a lot of this currency policies, like, it's not, as you said about Bernanke, you can always do more to stimulate demand. It's not clear to me that this is a necessary precondition of getting us out of the slump.
Well, if you think we have a crisis of demand, right, if you think that we're at, you know, if you think we're at 10% unemployment instead of, let's say, 7% unemployment, right, if you think 7% would be a good, like, if we didn't have a national recession, but we did have, you know, this big real estate, you know, construction, you know, rationalizing going on, right? So there was an increase in structural unemployment, but we didn't have, you know, massive national recession on top, right? If you think 3% of our unemployment is just, you know, weak demand, right? Then, you know, the simple answer is to say, yeah, well, what we need to do is generate more demand, and however you do it is good. So if you don't think that's a necessary precondition, right, where do you start?
Oh, no, I'm in the same boat. So, like, I think that this might get us somewhere in demand in terms of the currency readjustment. But I'm always very sensitive to the political economy of a lot of this stuff.
Right.
And it's not been clear to me that the upside would come close to balancing out potential downsides. So I would like to see a little bit more specific math, especially from people who are agitating from this, like a little
right.
bit more specifics.
Well, what are the other irons in the fire?
I mean, if I really did, oh, okay, so I see what you're saying. Well, there aren't any, really, right? I mean, it's not clear to me that I think there'll be many less after the November election. I mean, so one thing is to take.
Well, theoretically, like, let's leave out the November election. Let's imagine we're rolling back 9 months or something, right?
Sure, sure.
You know, what are the policy irons we really have in the fire to, right? If you think I'm right, right, and the Fed feels and the Fed's position is not simply, well, we're, you know, horrible banker people,
oh.
and so we want to screw, you know, homeowners and the unemployed, and we want to make sure that the domestic interests that are, you know, that are aligned with lenders, you know, benefit on a relative basis, even if on an absolute basis everybody suffers, right? If you assume that's not true, and the Fed's worried about its own credibility for really good reasons, right? You know, then what are your other policy levers?
Well, I do think that the states bleeding out is a big issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I think earlier and more aggressive moves, and I didn't catch it at the time, but you know, that's a fault of a lot of people, I think, was to basically backstop the states in some way, take over whatever nationalize and federalize whatever entitlement programs you want from the state level to get it off their books. Ultimately, the progressive movement needs to move into a point where the social safety network is run through the federal government. That's part of a broader picture, but I think this would have been a good time to do it. I think it would have made fiscal sense to do it. You know, there are problems with the way states administer their budgets, but the entitlement programs are something that would have naturally moved to a federal solution. There's a couple different ways to go around new stimulus programs, but in continuing with the infrastructure, people are now, it's one of those things where I think when it came time for the stimulus program, people didn't quite think of how to actually have to spend money. And I think you're actually now starting to see really smart policy initiatives. In terms of the Fed,
what sorts of things are you talking about? I mean,
One thing I saw really interesting was something called dignity bonds. I think it's what it's called, from New America. Michael Lind's people put that out.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it's a work voucher for the elderly. So the elderly basically get work vouchers that they can assign to people to, like, you know, take them to the store, to clean their house, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's run through a, you know, kind of private company. Basically, the person in question would pay half of it, and then the other person, and the government would pay the other half.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like $10 an hour or whatever. And so it's a kind of elderly care.
Right.
One thing I'm conscious of is that a lot of the stimulus programs are very masculinist. So, you know, it's like we hire people to go build this bridge, and it
right.
emphasizes a certain type of person and a certain type of labor. And here is something that's much more service focused.
Right.
So if you think that a nice.
Although, to be fair, if you look at where sort of unemployment has spiked, right, it's spiked much, much faster and harder among men than among women.
Absolutely.
Right? There's like a good reason for it. I mean, one of these sort of, like, again, in the background structural questions, right, is kind of every time we have a recession, right, quote unquote guy jobs get hit, you know, worse than, you know, quote unquote pink collar jobs. And in the recovery, they recover less well. So that's like that's sort of a structural shift in the economy generally.
Yeah, no, I'm not signing up for like the end of men hypothesis or anything like right. that. But one nice side effect of it, that one could argue for the stimulus program, is that it sets people up with skills and career paths. And, you know, it's certain that healthcare will grow as a sector of our economy. So,
mm-hmm.
but it's very difficult to kind of come up with a, you know, WPA for medical work that's other than job training kind of stuff.
Right.
So
well, there's always Brad DeLong's healthcare plan. I don't know if you remember the.
I don't remember.
Yeah, he sort of floated it semi-facetiously in, I think, 2006 or 2007. It was before. I'm pretty sure it was before the Obama administration. You know, and it took a lot of flack because it had a big component for, you know, a version of sort of medical savings accounts as part of it. There was a medical savings account portion. There was a sort of, you know, national, you know, single payer catastrophic, you know, high deductible plan portion. And then there was a piece where he's like, you know, and I want to, you know, levy a bunch of, you know, sin taxes on, you know, alcohol and soda and cigarettes and, you know, whatever else is bad for you. And use that to, you know, hire, you know, as he put it, you know, an army of barefoot nurses to go, you know, basically door to door providing healthcare services at a price, you know, cheaper than free, right? Arguing that kind of the transaction costs associated with, you know, getting access to healthcare are high enough for some people that, you know, even when nominally they have access to it, they don't have access to it. And therefore there'd be big public health gains, which translate into economic gains, to, you know, shoving the services at them. I do tend to think that over a longer span of time, you know, looking at over, you know, a decade or two, that employment in sort of the healthcare and quasi-healthcare sector inevitably is going to, you know, explode. It's going to be interesting to see how the politics of that shape up, you know, depending on what the government's role is in being the actual employer. I would assume America being America that, you know, the politics will be uglier the greater degree that the government is the direct employer. But that would be right if you wanted sort of an image right. of a WPA style, initiative, that's what it would look like. We certainly wouldn't see, you know, people painting murals.
Right. It's actually interesting now. If you look back at some of the stuff that was done during the New Deal, it's like it's stuff like Google does now. You know, or mm-hmm. it's stuff that we've already set up things to do. So it's if you go back, you can find like the most detailed records of consumption of mm-hmm. what, because they just hired people to go around and ask people what they were buying. And so, like historical economists, like spend a lot of time with the New Deal information, just because like it was like, okay, well, you know, what can we hire? What are shovel ready projects? We'll go around and ask people what they're doing
right
now. So, and yeah, so we have a little bit of time left. I was wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about financial reform as we kind of recap the first 2 years of the Obama administration. There's
right.
anything in the New York Times about how they feel that the first chapter is over, and you know, Obama administration is already freaking out about how it's kind of over in terms of what they can accomplish.
Yeah, which I think is kind of, it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of silly, right?
Yes.
I mean, the administration is still going to be there. And if you look at, you know, the Clinton administration or the Reagan administration or any other administration that suffered, you know, big reverses after 2 years in their legislative position, there's plenty of accomplishment, right, that you can point to
right.
years afterwards. So, you know, it's difficult for me. It's difficult for me to see the, you know, the logic of that kind of self-pity, really. And if you want to make an argument about ways that structurally our political system has changed so that, you know, post-1982 Reagan administration or the post-1984 Clinton administration aren't, you know, good analogies to, you know, what the Obama administration could accomplish from here on, then you should be turning that argument into a fighting argument, you know, and why,
right.
you know, you should reorganize, you know, in response, you know, to that change in the structure of our you know, political system. But be that as it may,
I think you'll see some movement on the quote unquote constitutional option in the Senate,
yeah.
which basically allows them to rewrite the laws with a simple majority
mm.
at the beginning of a session. And I know I've noticed people are really starting to weaponize arguments against the Senate in much more sophisticated ways.
Well, certainly, like on the on the edges on the left, they've been doing that sort of for a while, and you saw sort of a version of that on the right. Right in the early years of the Bush administration, when they were, when the right was up in arms about, not getting enough judges through, right. So I think you always get on the sort of the activist end of things a certain degree of, why can't we just sort of clear the brush and reorganize things so that our current majority has, has more leverage than it does in our system. I think you need to figure out how to make, if you really believe those sorts of arguments, right, you need to figure out how to take them out of that realm of, of we can't get our ideas through because X, right, and make a very different kind of case, to the American people. But be that as it may, you asked about financial reform.
Yeah, so of the three big initiatives of the Obama administration, the stimulus, health care, and financial reform, I always feel like financial reform gets the least amount of coverage.
Mm.
In the least amount of sense that something really was a game changer. Part of that is, just that it's very difficult. Part of it's natural cynicism and how compromised a lot of people thought it was, myself included. You wrote a thing at the American Scene that kind
right.
of just gave a high-level overview that I really liked because I thought it was, here are eight things it impacts and here's a rough read on them. So I'd like
right.
to talk a little bit more about the bill.
Well, we don't have very much time, so... I'm least well informed about sort of the consumer protection side of it and probably most sort of boringly inclined to just sort of think, yeah, sure, we should have a stronger, consumer protection, agency there. It's not a very sort of deeply thought out opinion. The sort of philosophical thing where I had the most concern about, right, was sort of punting a whole bunch of questions to, and I understand why they did this, but punting a whole bunch of questions to the Basel process on the grounds that, if America gets out of sync with sort of the international consensus on bank regulation, then we'll just be disadvantaging our banks versus international banks and we'll hurt ourselves without actually gaining anything from it. So I sort of understand the logic of that, but the result was, right, that you got coming out, Basel III kind of doubles down on sort of the existing philosophy of bank regulation, which is let's try to measure risk really accurately, right? And wherever we see risk, let's make it really, really expensive, right? So that banks are incentivized to run, very, very low risk portfolios. And that's always struck me as a dangerous incentive structure, right? And I think in the wake of this crisis, it should be really obvious that it's a dangerous incentive structure. And so doubling down on it makes me very, very nervous. Even if we do better at measuring risk, right? And even if, the sort of the specific things that caused the crisis don't recur, and even if some of the new sort of newfangled elements, like a sort of a countercyclical capital requirement work, and I'm sort of skeptical that they'll actually work, but it's there. And the reason is, right, if you make it very, very expensive to hold risk, right, banks can you can only make money by taking risk, right? You know, the notion that banks can make, you know, any significant amount of money being truly pure service businesses, right, I think is a fallacy, right? And it's also not what banks are for, right? The purpose of banking is to turn savings into capital, right? If you don't need banks to do that, then you don't need banks at all, right? You could disaggregate what banks do into things that, you know, places like Google and Microsoft could do, right? If all we're doing is sort of providing, you know, services to people to figure out how they connect with the capital markets, right? You know, then you would have a very different business model and a very different regulatory architecture. The reason you need banks and bank regulations is that, you know, people put their savings to a certain extent in banks, and that's how it gets, you know, that pool of savings gets turned into capital that can use, you know, that can be used to grow the economy. And the only way you can make money doing that is by taking risk. Right. So if you tell the banks we're going to make it very, very expensive for you to take any risk, the incentive you set up is not don't take any risk, but don't take any risk that I can see. Right. Only take risks that are invisible. Right. And that's very much what you saw all through, you know, the last decade, right, leading up to the banking crisis, was a very strong preference for apparently risk-free transactions. Right. Banks ballooned their balance sheets enormously, but they kept a lot of it, you know, off balance sheet through, you know, a variety of different specialized vehicles, right, and set up all sorts of trades that looked like they were, you know, if, you know, riskless. You know, you have, you know, enormously high-rated counterparty hedging, enormously high-rated instrument, right, and thereby quote-unquote guaranteeing an income stream, right, and all, you know, there's a tail risk on all of those, and measuring the tail risk is impossible, right, so you have something that from all, any of the tools that we have, right, wouldn't show up as, you know, whether it's value at risk or any other tool, wouldn't show up as having any risk. And instead, there was an enormous amount of risk, you know, hiding there. Obviously, you're probably not going to have the crisis in exactly the same place, but if you have the same philosophy of how you're going to regulate the banks, which is, you know, fundamentally emphasizing on let's find the risk and charge for that, I feel like you're going to wind up getting yourself into the same problem. I would have liked to see the approach go exactly the opposite direction, which is to say, be much more aggressive about minimum capital requirements, right, and much more aggressive about finding, you know, and closing the holes of how you get around those, right, ways of moving things off balance sheet so they don't show up as when you're calculating how much capital the bank needs, right. Really focus on that end of it, and on the risk end, you know, nobody blew up because they had too much, you know, high yield debt on their books, right? They blew up because they had AAA debt that wasn't really AAA. You know, right. So why are we responding by saying, well, let's increase the amount of capital you need to hold against things that aren't rated or against things that have low ratings, right? It should be the other way around. Let's find the things that look like they don't have any risk and let's increase the capital charge on those.
Right. So the baseline is why we have risk-adjusted capital here is because, you know, if you have a baseline that if you don't charge for risk, then it distorts how people hold. If you put pressure on one end or the other, it's going to change things. So, like, if you have to hold the same capital if you're lending against GE versus, you know, an internet startup, it's going to distort the way you lend capital out. And
right.
I agree with you in the sense that there should be a two-tier approach. One is just a baseline capital versus total liabilities. Like, what you're saying, complement it with the risk stuff. Because at the end of the day, like I focus out a little bit more and say, well, the problem is why was that thing rated AAA? And why did we have securitizations that were set up to kind of collapse in a certain, one would argue, predictable way?
Right.
Much like reasons we talked about earlier. With you know, one person said that a lot of what you're seeing in the securitization part of this law is trying to get the George Bailey Bank's regulation and kind of common sense stuff into the capital markets, which is just not at all a good place for it. You know,
right.
Like it completely defies that kind of individualized local knowledge. And so how do you find that balance between the two? You know, we put out a report that talked about capital requirements, which you know, it's the more you talk to people, the more you can kind of get completely different opinions on what's the strengths and weaknesses of Basel III. We put out a report that argued that countercyclical will actually make it worse because you need a higher return on equity to keep up on that.
Mm.
And, you know, it'll basically encourage people to find the riskiest stuff at the height of the bubble. We'll do,
right.
People will outguess, like it's obvious the way they'll outguess it, which I found partially convincing. So, yeah, it's not clear how well the capital regimes will work. I mean, given what it is, I think it's strong. I think it tackles some of the obvious problems in the old regime, which was, you know, the ways to game it is to basically borrow very short term, like mm-hmm. finance everything on a credit card instead of a 30-year mortgage because you can turn it over easier,
right?
And until you can't, and then it blows up. And it also it covers that in a way that I thought was fairly convincing, which was good because it was an obvious problem for this kind of new capital markets banking.
Right. I think if you want to talk about sort of the politics of it, and you said sort of the thing that people talk about least is financial reform, mm-hmm. right? You know, and I think it's partly that the sort of the subject is abstruse, but I think it's also that the only way people can really evaluate it, right, and whether it quote unquote worked, right? There's two ways they could evaluate, you know, an ordinary person, you know, who's not conversant with the issues could evaluate financial reform, right? They could evaluate it based on tangible results, right? So if I think financial reform is about making it possible for my small business to get credit when I couldn't get it before, or for me to get a mortgage when I couldn't get it before, although I could have gotten it 2 years before that without any questions being asked, right, then if financial reform changes that in my life, I'm happy. And it's very unlikely that any of what's done really directly impacts that, you know, that situation. And the other way is sort of who is mad about it, right? If everybody seems happy about it, right, then,
right.
You know, then why would anyone believe that it is, you know, a response, you know, a successful response to, you know, gross malefaction, right? And I have an instinctive aversion, you know, to populist arguments, right? And I think, you know, populism sort of by definition is sort of, you know, exceptionally, you know, prone to demagoguery and bad, and therefore bad outcomes, you know, lose-lose outcomes. And that's populism of the left or of the right. But nonetheless, I kind of get the basic logic of, well, if I'm mad because, you know, this entity screwed me, right, and appears to have screwed everybody, right, and you've passed this big reform bill and, you know, that same entity doesn't seem terribly upset about it, right, why would I believe that you did anything to solve the problem? And so to that extent, I guess I sort of understand the sort of the self-pitying arguments of some of the Obama folks saying, you know, oh, we tried too hard to get it right, you know, and didn't worry enough about the politics. I think that's a particularly self-serving way of putting it. But I kind of understand what they're getting at, right? You know, they're saying, you know, they're articulating the difficulty how do you convince somebody that something you think is, you know, win-win is actually a win at all, you know, if they can't feel it.
Exactly. Well, and that's a good conclusion note. Noah, thanks for taking the time with speaking to me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.